This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Stan Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg is an award-winning writer, editorial consultant, and a recognized expert in the area of cancer support. Dr. Goldberg has 30 years' experience of counseling and coaching people living with cancer and their loved ones, and he's also experienced his own cancer journey. Dr. Stan Goldberg, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, you say very early on in your book, which is entitled Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient, A Guide to Communication, Compassion, and Courage, you say that at least once in your life, a loved one or a friend will say to you, I have cancer. Is the occurrence of cancer really that common?
It is. It's not only that common, but what has happened is with modern medicine, we are now living longer with cancer. So that's a double-edged sword. It's wonderful that we live longer, but it also means that all of those things that were associated with a cancer diagnosis lasts longer. So that's the current state right now. We're living longer, but we're living longer with symptoms and difficulties that we need to address.
So it sounds like with symptoms and anxieties and everything else that you need to address.
Yeah, we do. It's, you know, and I'm speaking not only from my personal experience, but from the people that I've counseled. When you receive a cancer diagnosis, oftentimes that's the turning point in your life. Very few of us know, you know, prior, at least myself, I did not know how to respond to receiving a life-threatening prognosis. And I think very few people do. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is I was just as ignorant 20 years ago when I first heard the words from a good friend of mine as some of the people who are now, who, you know, come to me for counseling. It's an area that we're afraid to deal with publicly.
Tell us about your own cancer journey. When were you diagnosed, and tell us about your path.
Well, 13 years ago, I received a phone call from my urologist and said, Stan, you have prostate cancer. And when I asked him what the prognosis was, he essentially said, it's indefinite, it's indeterminate. So I went through a period of time, probably about 6 months, where I was so shocked by the diagnosis that I laid in bed and I watched reruns of Law and Order until my wife told me I needed to get up. And I started thinking about what it was I was going to do with the rest of my life. And that became the impetus for becoming a bedside hospice volunteer, where I had a firsthand accounting of what it was like to live with cancer, and also to hear from the caregivers of people who were in hospice what they had gone through. And my journey continues. I still write about cancer. I still live with it, and I still try to cope with the changes that it causes in my life.
You know, not that there's any best way to tell anyone that they have cancer, but calling you on the phone and then telling you that your life expectancy is, I don't know, whatever it is, essentially, what did that feel like?
I was pretty much in shock when I heard the word cancer. Everything else was tangential to that. We all of us, when we hear the word cancer, we have preconceived images of what that is. And the people that I've counseled had the same reaction, whether it was a physician saying you have a mild form of skin cancer, or an oncologist saying you have stage 4 breast cancer. Almost doesn't make a difference. It's that the power of that word is so strong that what it can do is it can make you oblivious to everything you hear afterwards. And that was the case with me. I just didn't hear very much afterwards.
I can certainly understand that. Now, according to the National Cancer Institute, 14 million people in the United States have had a cancer diagnosis, and the number is rising. Is that
correct?
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, and as we get better in medical science, that number is going to rise exponentially until there's eventual cure, I hope, for cancer. But we're going to see more and more people, which means the likelihood that you will live your life without hearing someone say to you, I have cancer, is pretty remote.
Interesting. For you, when you had the diagnosis, you stayed in bed. It's interesting you would watch something that was basically about rules and regulations.
I never thought about that, but yeah, I think that probably was connected.
And you know, everything was wrapped up at the end of 60 minutes. There was a resolution, and
right.
It was typically it was a good, powerful resolution. So that was an interesting choice. When someone tells you that you have cancer or that they have cancer, what is a reasonable first response, first thing to say, first thing to do? Is there a reasonable way to behave?
Well, let me relate it to the first time that I heard someone say to me, I have cancer. This was a good friend of mine 20 years ago, and she called me. And she said, Stan, I just want to let you know I have stage 4 breast cancer. And I knew what that meant, and I didn't know what to say. So I ended up saying what most people say to a friend or relative, and it's, I'm so sorry. Let me know what I can do. And after I hung up the phone, I thought, there's got to be something more useful to say than those words. Yes, it expressed my compassion, but what can you do with that? And that became the impetus for this book. The question was, if you are compassionate, how do I take that compassion and transform it into something that's useful? You know, too many people worry about choosing the correct words. There are no correct words. No matter what you're going to say, you know, it won't make the cancer go away. But what you can do is take those words and think about what you can do to transform your compassion into something useful. So I'll give you a very good example of what happened to a person that I know of. She was going in for chemotherapy, and she had a friend who knew that. So, you know, the usual response is, well, you know, let me know what I can do to help. And even though those words are expressed with compassion, they aren't specific enough for the person who has cancer. So what this woman did was she called her friend and she said, I know you're having chemotherapy next Wednesday. I also know that's, you know, on Thursday you're going to do shopping. You're going to be exhausted on Thursday. I'm going to come over, and we're going to shop together, and this way I can take everything and put it away and get you all settled. Well, that was incredibly important to the person who was having chemotherapy because it was something very specific. And that's what I would suggest people do. Don't worry about the words you're going to use. Think about what you can say that would give the person with cancer a feeling that you really want to help.
Now, what if the person who tells you says, no, that's not necessary. I'm fine. I just wanted you to know. What do you do with that?
And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I would rather be over solicitous with what I want to do rather than holding back. And, you know, and I've had people do the exact same thing with me, where they offer to do something specific. And I said, well, you know, thanks a lot, but I really am able to do that by myself now. that didn't prevent them from re-asking that question later on or making offers later on. So, you know, if you were the person who's making the offer and it's rejected, that doesn't mean that the person who you made the offer to doesn't want you to make that same offer in the future.
And it also doesn't mean that they're rejecting you.
Absolutely not. They just, you know, it's real interesting because when you think about cancer or many other acute illnesses, they tend to be progressive. Even though my cancer is stabilized after 13 years of hormone therapy, there's certain abilities that I had that continue to diminish, and a lot of that has to do with loss of muscle mass. So what I was able to do, let's say, a year ago, I may not be able to do now. And that's why continually making offers of help is important in any illness that is progressive.
You make the point, and it's such a valuable one, and I'm not sure that we hear it often enough. And you suggest that one not underestimate the psychological effects of uncertainty. And, you know, certainly with cancer, I mean, there's so much uncertainty at the same time that there are so many advances. And just that not knowing, talk more about that.
Well, you know, I've had people who've had, I've counseled, who've had very minor skin cancers where, you know, the likelihood of it being, fatal is incredibly minimal. I've had other people who've had chemotherapy 20 years ago and have, you know, stayed supposedly cancer-free. It almost doesn't make a difference, the level of cancer that you've had or the number of years post-treatment. The element of uncertainty is always there. You know, you can have a doctor say you're cancer-free, but the person living with cancer knows if only one cell remains, there's the possibility that it could replicate, and once again, you're back into dealing with your cancer. So that uncertainty is there for most people that are living with cancer. What's difficult is to isolate that uncertainty just to the cancer. What tends to happen is it goes beyond that. So the person who is living with not knowing the prognosis is going to have that expectation shape almost everything they're doing. And, you know, it did it for me, and it's done it for many people that I've served.
The, you know, what's interesting is that if somebody says to you, if the doctor says to you, you are cancer-free, and you continue to be concerned about it, on the one hand, you're saying, well, that certainly makes a great deal of sense. On the other hand, I wonder about the significant others or the friends or the loved ones who, upon hearing that the doctor has said you're cancer-free, lose patience and lose compassion for the person who, even post that comment, is still, as you say, uncertain and perhaps more than a little bit concerned that it could come back again.
Well, I'll tell you what happened with my family. When I had my prostate removed and there was no evidence of the cancer for 6 months, and that was expected, but I knew that, you know, since my cancer had migrated out of the organ and beyond the surgical margins, that I would be living with it forever. So when my family got that first six-month report that there was no evidence of cancer, they became overly optimistic. And in their minds, you know, I was through with it, and I would live a long life, and that's how we would lead our interactions in our life from that point on. And I counseled them. I gathered them all together, and I said, look, you need to understand I will always have this cancer, and it will always be a threat to my life. And if we pretend that it isn't, we're going to miss a lot of opportunities to say things to each other that are important. Let's assume that, you know, you don't know how long I have to live, and let's lead our lives according, you know, to those parameters. So instead of it being depressive, it actually changed our relationships pretty significantly, and it became more meaningful. And so that's what I would suggest to loved ones, is not to get so overly optimistic that reality becomes something that you push in the background.
And I would think, as your loved ones who really want you to be well, they don't want you to have cancer, so they want to forget about it, and they want you to forget about it, because of course it's all done, but not really. Again, they're doing that out of their own sense of wanting you to be healthy and well.
And not only that, but they want us to feel good. They want us to be optimistic, to believe that we'll live forever. And I think for some people, that's important. I remember my mother's best friend had stomach cancer, and she was afraid of death, and she didn't want to hear about it. And for her, what was most beneficial is when people didn't tell her that she had stomach cancer and was dying. They gathered around her bedside and made her feel better about herself. Now, with some people, that's important. With other people, and I would say the majority of people living with cancer don't want a cheerleader. They want someone who is going to be there to help them as they go on this journey.
And in fact, I would suggest that if you've got somebody who's a cheerleader, in a lot of ways it doesn't give you the space to have whatever your feelings are about whatever is going on with the cancer or not inside of your body.
I agree completely.
And that can be so difficult, again, for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, some of the hardest things I've found in relationships is watching someone you love go through a difficult experience, and you know the best that you can do is just figuratively and literally hold their hand, and that you're not going to make a difference on the outcome, and you're not going to make a difference in preventing some terrible things from happening. So that acceptance, I think, is critical for supporting the person with cancer, regardless of the severity of the illness.
And for those folks listening who are saying, hold their hand, what does that matter? But in fact, it matters a great deal.
It does. I remember that, you know, I did hospice volunteering for 8 years, and I eventually had to stop because of my own health issues. But some of the most meaningful interactions I had with patients who were dying was just to sit next to them, witness their pain, hold their hand, and essentially say to them by my actions, I'm with you. I know I can't do anything to change it, but I'm here with you, and I'll experience your pain. We'll experience it together.
So the idea that that person was not alone was extraordinarily helpful.
Absolutely.
And what was the impact on you?
Well, you know, it teaches you acceptance. I mean, my whole professional career, what I always tried to do is think about how to change things. I was a speech-language pathologist for 30 years, and my whole purpose of being was to change difficult situations, to enable people to do behaviors that they thought were impossible. Well, when you're in hospice, that doesn't happen. There's a saying that we use, and that is, there are no emergencies in hospice. You know, people are there to die, and our purpose was to be compassionate with them. So that's basically a lesson that I couldn't have learned in any other way. You know, the acceptance of what we can't change and learning to adapt to, you know, what is inevitable.
Dr. Stan Goldberg, who is author of Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. We will take a break and be right back. for guidance around typical comments that people will often make when they hear that someone has a cancer diagnosis. You point out that someone will often say, you should be proud you are a survivor, or you're so brave in your battle with cancer, and you're saying, not so good. You don't need to say those kinds of things. Why is that? What's wrong with them?
Well, I think when you use the term such as survivor, there's always the possibility that you could blame the person when their cancer is not doing, when their cancer is overcoming them. I had a patient that I served in hospice who related to me the stories of her friends that were incredibly supportive of her. And when she told them that she had uterine cancer, what they said to her was, we're in this with you. We will fight it together. We will do everything that we're supposed to do. We'll do the nutrition, the exercise, whatever the doctor suggests. And it was wonderful, you know, and she felt terrific. And she felt very supported. But as the cancer got more virulent, no matter what they did, nothing helped. And she was in hospice, and she knew she was going to die within 3 or 4 weeks. And what she said to me was, I feel that I let down my friends. You know, we were all supportive, and if I just had tried harder, I could have beat this. Now, it's a feeling I think that a lot of people with cancer have, is that if you view your fight with cancer as a battle, if you don't succeed, it becomes your fault rather than anything endemic to the illness itself. So for me, I never, you know, it's been 13 years, I don't think of myself as a survivor. I think of myself as someone who has learned to cope with the cancer. So I don't want to be placed on a pedestal. I don't want people to look at me as being brave. What I want them to do is to compliment me on how I'm coping with this illness. And the people that I've counseled, most of them have that same feeling, that's what they want. There are some people that relish being a survivor and looking at it as a battle. And for them, I think that works. But for many people, that's not how we want people to view us.
You say that you want to be complimented on how you're coping.
Mm-hmm.
How are you coping?
Well, I'll give you, before the cancer diagnosis, I was an avid fly fisherman, and I would go out by myself into the wilderness for 5-6 days, and it was wonderful, and that was part of my identity. When I got the cancer diagnosis and I started having the treatments after the gland was removed, my energy level, you know, dramatically decreased. And I was no longer able to do the thing that I love most, which is to go off by myself in the wilderness. So instead of feeling that my life was over, I tried to think about what I could do in order to experience the same kind of emotions that I had fishing. And I realized that what I missed was serenity, not necessarily the fishing. So what I did was I searched for things that could provide the sense of serenity that I lost. And I got that through crafting wooden flutes and learning how to play them. So that was an example of coping. You know, the person who was an athlete who can no longer run but now enjoys walking for a mile should be complimented. They've learned how to cope. And in every situation where cancer is taking something away, the person can find a way of coping with it. So that's what we should be complimented about, you know, how we're changing to meet reality.
It's interesting because what I hear you focusing on is what you can do versus what you can't do. You know what you can't do, but you're really putting some energy on what you can do differently.
Absolutely. And the thing is that with cancer, if it's progressive, that's going to change continually. So what I'm able to do today, I may not be able to do tomorrow. You know, I can move wood now. I can handle large pieces of wood in order to make my flutes. But I know that, you know, maybe next year that's not going to be possible, and I'll adapt in other ways. I'll have someone bring the wood to me. So it's continually adapting to an illness that's unstable.
And also for the caregivers, it's a continual adaptation to what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, the cancer is not something that's just that just involves the person with it. It's a community event. You know, I know that the way that I feel affects my wife and affects my adult children, and it affects friends. So it you know, I never view what I'm experiencing as isolated from what other people experience. So yes, it definitely is a community event, and caregivers often have to do more adaptations than the person who's living with cancer.
That's interesting. So that could suggest that caregivers actually might be more frustrated than one would think, or more puzzled or concerned about their ability to care in a way that is useful.
Absolutely. And that was another reason why I wrote the book. You know, I kept reading different accounts of what could be done to help people with cancer. They all were very general. They weren't things that I had found useful. So in the book, there's more than 240 very specific things for caregivers that they can use to make the cancer journey of their friend or loved one easier.
One of the points that you make, which I think is so valuable, is to advise that the caregiver, or even somebody who's not a caregiver but a friend, so in effect, by virtue of their friendship, they're giving care, that they really focus on the person's experience of the cancer rather than how they would experience the cancer if they had gotten the diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that regardless if we're talking about cancer or anything else in life, we always start with the premise, if I was them, if I was her, this is what I would do. And oftentimes we make judgments on other people's behavior based on our values and our experiences. And I think that's a typically normal thing to do. The problem, though, with cancer is the person with a cancer diagnosis enters into a different world. And it's a world that a caregiver may not be that experienced with. So for them to say, well, you know, if I was them, I would do, you can't say that because you haven't had that experience. Mm-hmm. Living with I mean, I look at my life as in two big phases, before my cancer diagnosis and afterwards. And they're two really different lives. Before the diagnosis, at the university, I was very objective, very clinical, very straightforward, very linear. Since the cancer diagnosis in the past 13 years, I think I've become more sensitive, definitely less analytical, more willing to interact on an emotional basis, and many other things. It's a different life. So if a friend or caregiver looks at what someone with cancer is doing, you know, the best approach is to accept it rather than saying, if I was him, this is what I would do.
You also say that one shouldn't be a cheerleader. And I think the real push is to be a cheerleader.
Yes. And, you know, and it doesn't mean that I think people need to go around with a scowl and feel terrible about everything. But being a compassionate caregiver really involves walking this ridge. And on the one side of the ridge is the reality of what the cancer is doing. The other side of the ridge is the hope that something positive will occur. And I think it's a constant battle that people who don't have cancer face. Is how am I going to walk this ridge so I'm not too positive, you know, I'm overly positive and I'm not too negative. And it's a constant battle that someone takes. one of the suggestions, I think, in the book came from a couple that I counseled who were in hospice. And she was a nurse, an oncology nurse, who was very familiar with what was happening with her husband's pancreatic cancer. And, you know, she knew that the likelihood of him surviving was minimal. But she didn't want to make that the focus of their interactions. So what she started to do was to think about what could we do that is positive, given the fact that this is this will be a tragic end. So she thought about making, you know, look of trying to achieve goals that were reasonable. So, you know, one goal was let's see if we can make it around the block before you become too tired. And, you know, that was good. And, you know, he did that, and they both felt good about what was accomplished. That, you know, was following that ledge rather than focusing on, yeah, but he'll be dead next week. So it's those kinds of things. Look for specific goals that are achievable that you can cheerlead about, but not to be a cheerleader for unrealistic expectations.
Gotcha. So don't deny reality.
Exactly.
If you have a cancer diagnosis and you also have children, what do you say to your children?
Well, you know, there isn't one specific thing to say. I think it depends upon the age of kids. From the time that my children were old enough to understand things, let's say the age of 5 or 6, we talked about end of life issues because we knew we had relatives who were dying, we had friends who were, you know, had difficult illnesses, and we started talking about that. For me, what I've seen is in societies where death is viewed as a part of living, there's less anxiety when you're faced with it. Now, unfortunately, I think in Western society, we do the reverse. We cut off death from life, and therefore it becomes very frightening. I'm not sure, you know, how one goes about within that cultural parameters of fearing death to make a person's death more acceptable to children. So I don't think I spent too much time in the book talking about that, because that's an area that, you know, in all honesty, I'm not sure how to deal with.
Okay. You know, it is difficult because you want to tell them what's age appropriate, but what's age appropriate is determined not only by your child's age, but by your child's personality and spirit and all that. So it is a very complicated issue.
You
make a point that, which actually surprised me until I read more of what you were saying, which is that you should minimize noise if you think your partner is using it for distraction. Talk about that.
I think that, you know, cognitively, we need to think about how we process information. And as people become more ill, and as they realize that there are things they need to tie up before dying, you know, almost anything can interfere with that process. Noise is one of those. So noise, you know, can be both positive and negative. If I'm trying to understand my life, and if I'm trying to make amends to maybe people that I've had difficulties with, I want that, you know, I want the environment to be as clean as possible, and clean being, you know, no noise. And you know, noise is both regular noise, it can be music, it can be a variety of things. So you reduce noise in those situations. However, many people have a great deal of difficulty facing their death. And because of that, they do want distractions. I've had people who found solace in the use of drugs, other people who would turn on the TV and, you know, let it run 24 hours a day so they didn't have to think about things. So, you know, noise has both a positive and a negative effect.
And it sounds like you really want to be mindful of the pattern and the practice of the noise usage to get a handle on what's really going on.
And absolutely. I think that, you know, if your partner is listening to music 24 hours a day, that's usually a sign that for whatever reason, he doesn't want to talk about his upcoming death. And so, yes, I think, you know, you watch the use of noise and you think about it as a diagnostic indication of what your partner needs.
You are also very clear in suggesting that one should not be afraid to talk about death. And death is often the D word, you know, just as cancer for many years was the C word.
Say
more about that.
Well, when I was in hospice, again, I was there for 8 years, and in 8 years' time, I never brought up the topic of dying. I mean, even though, you know, it would be very natural since everybody was in hospice and they knew why they were there, I never had to bring the topic up. It was something that every one of my patients wanted to talk about at some point. If you have a loved one or a friend with a serious form of cancer that you're sure is terminal, and you may think, well, maybe I should talk about it or bring up the topic. I would caution against that, because what I found in my counseling is that people will only hear things when they're ready to hear. Someone who is very afraid of death may have a great deal of difficulty talking about that. Initiating the topic doesn't necessarily work. What I found most helpful is, and I counsel people to do this, is if you have someone who's afraid to talk about dying, think about the leads that they're giving you that might be a way into the topic. So, for example, I had a patient with terminal cancer, and he and his wife had booked a cruise, and the cruise clearly was going to happen long after he, you know, would still be alive. And so what his wife did was start focusing on the last date they could ask for their deposit back. And that became the entry for talking about his eventual death. So those are the kinds of things that loved ones and friends need to think about. Does the person I'm caring about have difficulty talking about death? And if so, can I wait until they're more amenable to that? And if I can't, are there certain things that they'll say or I can say that may be the entree into discussing death?
Gotcha. Dr. Stan Goldberg, author of Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. We will take a break and be back in just a moment. Dr. Goldberg, certainly we know that in the world of all kinds of treatment, medical treatment, there are changes between how it's addressed today and how it was addressed yesterday. And certainly yesterday, cancer treatment was not nearly, I would suggest, as outpatient as it is today. So what is your personal thought about that? Do you think that folks who are diagnosed with cancer do need to stay inpatient for a period of time, or do you find that the outpatient approach is a better one?
Well, from what I've been told by people who've had both, most people prefer outpatient, especially if they have a strong support system.
And if they don't have a support system, then inpatient would be preferable to them. Although in today's world, I'm not sure that inpatient would be an option.
Yeah, it isn't an option in most cases.
Okay.
And even for those people who don't have a supportive system outside, I'm not sure they're going to find the support they need in inpatient units. I think the medical community has vastly improved on its ability to be to deal with the psychological needs of their patients, but I still think they have a long way to go.
Do you have any personal thoughts about the various cancer treatment centers that we often hear about in commercials or infomercials or whatever? What's your thought?
I really don't. I mean, I've heard both positive and negative things about some of the well-known cancer centers, but without personal knowledge, I would be very reluctant to evaluate any of them.
Okay, fair enough. When you are dealing with cancer, and perhaps before you got that diagnosis, your life was very ordered, very structured, how do you make the transition to the need to be flexible if for no other reason than you may not know how you're going to feel tomorrow and tomorrow?
Yeah. Last week, I just did a presentation, and it was, what would you do if you knew you had 24 hours to live? Hmm. And the answers that people gave were very interesting. What I found is that when there's the possibility that you may die soon, everything changes. Your values change. The need to be structured changes. And what tends to happen is when something like a cancer diagnosis is introduced into your life, what you'll start doing is reassessing what's important to you. And that I find to, if there's anything that's positive about a cancer diagnosis, that's it. You're forced to reassess what's important. And quite often, following that reassessment, your life, regardless if it's long or short, tends to be significantly more meaningful.
Interesting. That makes sense, actually, as you think about it. Well, given that there are so many different options in terms of treatment for pretty much everything, and that the internet is certainly alive and well in terms of guidance, recommendations, etc., if you, as a friend of someone with a cancer diagnosis, are starting to hear your friend talk about what you consider to be exotic treatments, do you support that friend or do you back away?
Well, that's exactly what happened with my brother-in-law, who was dying of brain cancer. And he had, gone through some of the great procedures at Johns Hopkins, traditional medicine. And, even though they were able to get most of the tumor, they couldn't get all of it. And essentially what they said to him was, we've done the best we can. He, in turn, though, was not willing to accept that. And he got online, and there's lots of chat groups that support very controversial methods for treating cancer. And he got on one of these sites. The procedure, the surgical procedure that they were suggesting was bizarre, and it wasn't supported by any major cancer group. And the question then became, how do I deal with that with him? Because I was a long-distance caregiver for him. We were in California. He was in Florida. And, you know, I thought, well, what would make the most sense, if I'm just looking at reality, was to say to him, this doesn't, you know, this is a terrible approach. It's unscientific, undocumented, and forget it. But for him, what was more important for him was a sense of hope. And what I try to do with him is what I suggest other people do. If you have someone you love who is adopting to something that makes no sense, you can try to bring in evidence from various recognized groups, American Cancer Society, National Institute of Health, that talk about that specific thing. So that's the first step, the first thing to do. If that doesn't work, then you may be required to do, you know, what I said happens quite often with people in hospice, where you have to sit there and literally, figuratively and literally hold their hand. When my brother-in-law decided to go ahead with his treatment, and I knew there was nothing I could say or do that would prevent him, then I stayed with him prior to the operation, after the operation, and dealt with all of the terrible consequences that came with it. So sometimes that's what you're left to do. One other aspect is multiple therapies. I thoroughly believe in a shotgun approach. I do traditional medicine. I think about my nutrition. I do exercises, as many things that I do. And the caveat for me, as long as there's nothing here that would subvert my, you know, the traditional intervention, I'm fine. You know, I'll do it. So those are the three kinds of situations that can be involved when someone is choosing an intervention that you don't think makes much sense.
You know, I can just imagine someone who has cancer asking their friend for some financial help. I mean, some of these interventions are expensive. And certainly if they're non-traditional, they're not covered by medication. So
yeah.
What do you do with that? You've got your friend, you love your friend, you care about your friend. And let's say your friend knows that technically you have the financial wherewithal to provide the support, but you really object to it.
Well, I think one of the things that I usually counsel people on is when you make a decision, think about what the goal of the action is. Why am I doing this? If you have a friend who is choosing an intervention that you think has low probability, and you can afford to provide them with funds, and they ask you for it, you need to think about what is the purpose of these funds. If you think about that the purpose is to cure the person, then it obviously doesn't make any sense. But if the reason is to give them a sense of hope that they desperately need, then that might justify providing those funds.
Okay, so again, it sounds like so much is built upon the perspective with which you approach your own cancer, if you're the one dealing with it, and the perspective with which those around you approach your need for almost kind of fill in the blanks, need for hope, need for acceptance. I mean, they're just a range.
Absolutely. I think something that people should always grasp onto, the world of a person who is healthy is different than the person living with cancer. And those differences affect everything.
I want to go back to the experience of feeling guilty because you have an illness. So many times the person who is experiencing the illness and the guilt isn't going to really talk about it, but they're certainly going to be burdened by it. Is there anything more you can add to that experience for folks?
Well, you know, I've never felt guilt was a very positive emotion. I haven't encountered that many people who feel guilty about contracting cancer. There are some people who think back that if they had only not eaten certain kinds of food or had moved from an area that may have been contaminated, they wouldn't have cancer. But I think that affects very few people.
Okay.
And in the if you have a loved one who has those feelings of guilt, I think it's important that they understand that even though we understand many things about cancer, the origin often is still undetermined. So there's no reason to feel guilty about contracting this illness.
Okay. What about, you talk about the side effects of treatment and a need for those who are caring for the person with cancer to really understand those side effects. Are there typical side effects that folks should be aware of?
Well, it ranges from the types of cancer people have and the types of treatment. With my treatment, I have hormone injections every 6 months or so, and it causes me to have a lot of the exact same symptoms that women go through with menopause. And I joke with friends. I'm probably the only male in a room when listening to women talk all about how terrible menopause is, and I'm the only one who can say, I know, and say that from personal experience. So,
and then their heads twist around because they don't get how you know.
Right. Well, these people didn't know I have cancer, and
okay.
They all become hysterical.
Okay.
But it's the same with, you know, with other forms. You know, if someone has a cancerous condition that results in intermittent pain, then that's going to dominate everything they think about. It's going to dominate the decisions that they're making. It'll introduce a lot of instability. One of the things that I think many people who are healthy don't realize is that the person living with a life-threatening illness starts to see everything through the perspective of I may not be here next week. And that just changes everything. So if you're not sure what your friend is experiencing, assume that any radical changes in their behavior are related to something about that cancer rather than anything you did wrong.
Okay. I think that's such a critical point. You also make the point that dying is hard.
It is. You know, I think that what an interesting thing happens when people get ready to die. If you think about how we develop, how our instincts develop and our defenses develop, you know, we start off life as a kid, and something comes to our mind, and we say it. You know, there's no filters. As we continue to age, those filters develop, and we, you know, in the form of defenses. When someone gets closer to dying, a lot of those just fall away as you know, extra layers of clothes would when you're entering into a warm room on a cold day. And as those things evaporate, what I've seen is an unbelievable honesty that people have about their lives, about their regrets, about many things. And I think that as people get closer to dying, those are the kinds of issues that become very important. And it's difficult. You know, it's very difficult for someone to think about, you know, what they could have done throughout their lives that would have made their deaths easier. It's very difficult for someone to think about all of the things, all of the people that they offended. So, you know, it's very hard work. Dying is not easy. It involves a tremendous amount of introspection.
And introspection, even without a significant diagnosis, is often difficult for people to do.
Absolutely.
Stan, what would you say are a reasonable set of first steps, if you will, for someone who's just received a cancer diagnosis? Are there particular steps?
For the person who receives the diagnosis,
yes.
Or the person who hears about it?
For the person who hears about it. Thank you.
Well, I think that you need to basically think about how can I take the compassion that I'm feeling for this person and transform it into something that is practical and useful. That's the first thing. The second thing is to understand that the world of the person with cancer is different than the world of the person who is healthy. And maybe the third thing is that you are being invited on a journey. Think about it as an honor. And as you're on this journey, your role is to provide support to the person who is living with cancer rather than making judgments about what they're doing.
Dr. Stan Goldberg, author of Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient, A Guide to Communications, Compassion, and Courage. Stan, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website you would like to share?
Yes, my website is Stan Goldberg Writer, WRITER.com. And on that website, you'll find more than 200 articles, free articles you can download and share on cancer, aging, dementia, acute problems, caregiving. I also have a website on verywell.com, VERYWELL.com. And on that site, I write a new article on caregiving once a month.
That's wonderful. Thank you again, Stan, for joining us today.
Welcome.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications and is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org, or you can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's MYNDTALK.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.